So the poems that I have in the obsession issue, to forego any subtlety, are cat poems. And which is dangerous for a woman who lives in New York City. And so I decided as a constraint I would read poems that only have cats in them, and I thought that would be interesting for me to think about what to read. And then I noticed that I could read anything I wanted because there's a cat in practically every single one of my pieces. So I didn't know that, but I have. So I do have cat, all cat. I'm in all cats tonight. This first poem, it's called, the title is Snowing Oven, and it answers a question in Jean Arp's poem, What Is That? And the question is, there is nothing but snow in that white hot stove. It doesn't sound like a question, does it? Those are the best kind of questions, I think. Snowing oven. When you open your smiling oven, steaming noodles and goodies, some snow leopards sleep on the mount of my tongue. So adept in hiding are they that I barely know when they're there. Though sometimes a purr melting through me, preheat. Open wide, there is nothing in your mouth, just a wintry mix, groomed trails, slopes, more snow squalls, more drifts. I get it. You wouldn't say what is in the oven. Your mouth closed for the weather, for winter, snow spices, pecans. After all, melting is not the same as disappearing. Your open smile, heat. If I drill through your snow to the hidden lake region, baking ancient snow, swirling frosting, icing. It's snowing, nothing to do but bake. Always so tempting to open a warm, fresh smile. This is a poem in the issue of Conjunctions called Cat. The cat belongs to me. The cat belongs to the house. The cat belongs to the other cat. The cat belongs to itself. The cat belongs to the bird and mouse. The cat belongs to the mountain lion. The cat belongs to no one. The cat belongs to nothing. The cat belongs to everyone, everything. The cat has a name that I gave it. Everyone knows the cat's name is not its name. It's my name for the cat. Sometimes the cat refuses to acknowledge this name, and sometimes the cat plays along with the life I've created for the cat. Sometimes the cat pretends that it doesn't live in a realm different from the one that the cat and I live in together. The cat has needs that must be met for the cat to live in my house, though most of the cat's time is spent elsewhere. I invite the cat to live with me so I can perceive much of this elsewhere in which the cat spends much cat time. The cat shares what I can't see by maintaining an existence in my house and by responding to the name I gave the cat. I know there will be a moment in the circuitry of space-time in which the cat will discard the name and forsake my house for good, and will exist only in the fields I cannot see without the cat living in my house. On that day, I might say the cat has moved full-time into the wild, or I might say meow meow has run away. Jerome Sala has a wonderful blog, if you're not familiar with it, called Espresso Bongo, and it always has these really smart, pointed blog entries. And Jerome wrote on this, he's covering his face. I'm sorry. I can't help it. Forget it. Okay. Anyway, it's Espresso Bongo. This is the other poem. It's called Hey Diddle Diddle. And most of these poems are, I mean, not poems, moons, poems, moons. There's a similarity there with the sound, right? Most of these moons in this poem are names of moons. that somebody calls the moon at some time. Certain moons. Okay, that makes no sense. Hey, diddle, diddle. And the cat jumped over the milk moon, the spoon moon, the sleepy mean moon, not the flying fish moon or the tiger shark moon, moon of the terrible, moon of the raccoon, not the moon that swung atop the arboretum, the peach moon, peony moon, the moon when trees pop, the lotus moon, mum moon, raspberry, blackberry, or sassafras moon. It was the pelican moon that perched on the crane moon. The cat never jumped over the secret moon peeping out of swift high cloud, the bony moon, the windy moon, the hungry moon, the moon of ice, singing moon, oh mulberry moon, with a full moon's might. The maroon-colored cat jumped over the magnificent moon of horses, the moon when geese return to scattered formation, when the calves grow hair, the moon when leaves are green, the moon when leaves are gone. Never the dreaded dragon moon, the panther moon, the moon when horns are broken off. Never the 12th moon when a million brilliant eyes light dense bramble below the most hallowed one. The moon when eyes are sore from staring at bright moonlit snow. This poem is called The Philosophy of Housekeeping, and it was published in a past conjunctions. And it's kind of channeling Emily Dickinson's dream, a couple of dreams that Emily Dickinson had. And there are some footnotes, and I'll read a couple, but not all of them. It starts off with a footnote, and that footnote is, a poem without eye wanders purgatory, swims through tormented seas of unsown sheaves, travels farther into summer than birds. Five Chinese brothers live with retarded cats, wander the edge of the wood in wait. The five brothers with one name, one nature, with five gills, five gifts, housed in one body with five doors. As Emily dreams, she floats to the top floor, head in clouds, laughing helium, a cup of cinnamon tea. She visits the five chiming brothers who save her from drowning, burning, fading, shrinking. Nightly she retreats into a spectral episode, and the brothers draw near, sing to her, recite her favorite lies, bouquets of jasmine and buttercup pregnant with songbird scent. A goldfinch Eucharist flutters against her teeth, ooh, attempts to escape belief. In one dream she's a porn star, wraps her diminutive thighs around a pole, how she wraps her mind around death. Poem after pole after poem. And then she's dressed in Frankenstein's creation, her bodice and crushed girdle, a patchwork of putridity, baking loaves of gingerbread, sifting sugar, licking tears from hummingbird's eyes. Always she's Emily, recalling a world in a house, objects in a kitchen, desire, hope, love, now rolling pins, an herbarium, the wire mousetrap. She embraces each noun that will vanish when she dies to the nothing it came from. The word, the way a cloud pie flies. There's a note on the cloud pie, so I'll just read that. It's a recipe on how to make it. Place 1/2 cup of cloud in glass bowl. Saturate with lemon water, a pinch of salt from teardrops. Introduce feathery chartreuse, magenta, cobalt, and green. Slowly fold in memories of pleasure until light and well blended. The way a cloud pie flies like a bee buzzing past the ear, flakes and tenderly melts. Night blows out the single star for fear, trombone, air, troubadour. I'm going to read from my novella, 2X Square. This is a very short chapter, and you just need to know that, well, the narrator's name is Nora. You probably don't really need to know that, but now you know. And this is a story about how her parents met. Her father's a stevedore, and her mother is a stepmother, and she's Chinese, and her name is Mu Qin, and that means mother in Chinese. And so that's, yeah, that's all you need. Okay. The scientist whose life work was to study fog had died. The scientist who spent his life exploring the field of fog, who dedicated his life to the study of fog. As a student, he could not have foreseen that he would specialize in fog, that he would shine a fresh light on the study of fog as a fogologist. Eulogies were given by his esteemed colleagues in the Department of Fog on the cloudy day that he was buried. The words fog and God were invoked and substituted for one another effortlessly, as often occurs on the commonplace yet momentous occasion of one's death. The study of fog was greatly advanced because of his insights. He would have his assistant sweep sunshine off the laboratory deck for hours until time could not be counted, sweeping away sunshine, invoking the invisibility of dew, moisture, fog. The assistant's balled up fists clutching a broomstick, sweeping, sweeping. She'd tiptoe up to the window of the high-tech hole in the wall, fog-like, and spy on the scientist, fogging up the window with her breath. The liquid assistant would dream of fog. Every morning, she'd plan on quitting her low-paying job, but upon seeing the slow-crawling fog drag itself across her mysterious lake, she'd suit up as if a prisoner of some purpose she couldn't understand, reach for her graying khakis, float into them, and then out the door to work. Fog is fog, not moisture, not cloud. It is adorned with no solid form. Since fog is adorned with no solid form, fog is adorned with fog's no solid form. Fog is the killing of fog adorned with no solid form. Therefore, fog is fog as fog, and fog is not fog as fog. And sunshine can be swept and swept for hours and still leave some stain of light, morning until night, adorning the form of liquid wood, which is trees, which is fungus, which is worms, which is fog. The day the stevedore appeared at the lab was most unusual. First off, that day there was no fog creeping over Mooking's lake. So after opening an eye that morning and peering out her window, she quickly closed it and fell back into a deep, deep sleep, a forest sleep. When she awoke several hours later and arrived several hours late to work, she expected her boss, who was lead scientist in the study of fog, to upbraid her, but he did no such thing. Instead, he complimented her on her clothes, not the grayish work pants she always wore, but a white lab coat, not the blue she'd wear when she wasn't dressed for work, but an emerald frock, the color of gleaming seaweed. The stevedore was a danger from the moment her boss introduced them. "He is the fog," she thought, "crawling over the lake to come to me. He is the fog beckoning me to follow." My stepmother never feigned innocence about my father. She understood what he was from the moment he followed her up the stairs to her top floor. "And he disappeared like fog," she said to me. I had many questions for her about the day the fog skipped the lake and entered her life, but because of the precision of the way she relayed the story, the formulation of it really, I was unable to voice them. Mook King addressed me as a scientist offering a student an equation to be memorized, not as a mother telling her daughter how she met her father, "and he disappeared like fog." One stepmother started seeing the stevedore. He would appear to her at odd hours and with unique and thoughtful gifts. During one of his typically irregular visits, he brought me. "My daughter," he said, placing me in the crux of my stepmother's willowy arm. Mook King rubbed the soft spot on the top of my head and was delighted as I beamed back to her. Stepmother says my beacon of light shone on her first before anyone else. Of course, my stepmother could not have known such a thing. Nevertheless, her version of the incident has become family myth. The other myth regarding my arrival is that my father found me in a reed basket by a stream with a giant blue cat protector. See, the story goes that the cat hissed at every passerby who'd come near except for father. You probably were wondering when the cat was going to come in. When he approached, the cat opened his mouth ever so slightly and immediately abandoned his watch, leaping into the forest. My stepmother quit the lab soon after she began raising me, but when the scientist died, she threw flowers and honey into the ocean and she howled in the wind. What can I say? It's the only story I've been told about my birth, told to me by my stepmother, who is magnetized by fog, who is fog, not moisture, not cloud, adorned with no solid form. Since fog is adorned with no solid form, therefore fog is adorned with fog's no solid form. Fog is the killing of fog with no solid form. Fog is the fog adorned with no solid form. Therefore fog is fog as fog, and fog is not fog as fog. Thank you.